Welcome to this session for the presidential address. According to time-honored custom, there will be no opportunity for questions. A fable. Once upon a time, there were two tribes seeking their separate but parallel destinies. Every year they would meet together for a gigantic powwow, until Tribe A decided their fair name was being besmirched by association with Tribe B and cancelled the powwows. Tribe B was hurt, but decided to heap coals of fire on the heads of Tribe A by inviting one of their most distinguished elders to become the leader of Tribe B for a year. So shamed were Tribe A by this selfless act that before too long they repented of their unfriendly action and desired of Tribe B that they should once again meet together for their powwows in the same place and at the same time. That is not entirely the true background of the election of Jonathan Z. Smith, the distinguished historian of religion, as president of the Society of Biblical Literature, though I'm afraid it may well be how future generations remember the events of our own times. From the SBL's point of view, Jonathan Smith is a brilliant choice for president, whether or not he has anything to do with the AAR. Jonathan Smith's title is Robert O. Anderson Distinguished Service Professor of the Humanities at the University of Chicago. His scholarly reputation rests on the corpus of his unique contributions to the study of religion in general and religions in particular. Not everyone knows that he is also, by training and by seasoning, a regular New Testament scholar, albeit with the fisheye lens of a scholar of religion rather than, shall we say, the microscope of a student of the synoptic problem. One New Testament-oriented study was Drudgery Divine, 1990, where he subversively compared early forms of Christianity with the mystery religions, proving himself, as one canny reviewer said, the greatest pathologist in the history of religions. He almost didn't do his PhD at Yale because there was no one to mentor a bright and no doubt wayward young student who wanted to challenge the parallelomania of the golden bough of J.G. Fraser. Smith had to develop his own tools for the comparison of one religion or one religious practice with another, tools that would prevent easy conflation of one set of data with another, and that would always respect the individuality of the particular case. Proper methods of comparison were to remain a running theme through almost all his work from that time, through Map Is Not Territory, Studies in the History of Religion, 1978, Imagining Religion from Babylon to Jonestown, 1982, To Take Place Toward Theory and Ritual, 1987, and Relating Religion, Essays in the Study of Religion, 2004. Not long after Yale, he was appointed to the University of Chicago in 1968, and there he spent the last 40 years. These days, he takes a special pride in teaching only at the college, the undergraduate component of the University of Chicago. There he shapes the minds of the more or less impressionable youth of today with his RLST 10100, Introduction to Religious Studies, which I guess is the most important and most formative class in religion they will take. Introducing, he says, is an old person's game. It's not a young person's game. A young person has just spent years becoming the world's expert on some itty-bitty little thing, and that's the last person in the world you suddenly give the overview to. unlike those religion scholars who apparently believe that religion is a good thing and the more you can get of it, the better, Jonathan Z. Smith gives off an air of detachment about his subject matter, as if, forsooth, in a day of advocacy scholarship and self-serving critical thinking, he were a disinterested academic historian of religion. Religion in all its manifestations fascinates him, but it doesn't seduce him. It's enough for him to bring disparate sets of data together, the Quran with the Book of Mormon, 19th century Maori cults with religiously inspired mass suicide in Jonestown, dropping one in the other's pond to see what happens, as he puts it. Jonathan Smith celebrated his 70th birthday yesterday. Like myself... like myself, born on the same day... he finds that his birthday always falls during the SBL annual meeting. I give you the precedent for 2008, not so much homo religiosus as anima naturalita SBLiensis.
Thank you, David. That's a myth I shall not exegete this evening, and good evening. When we last convened our annual meeting in Boston 9 years ago, I was invited to present a plenary lecture to the Society. I chose then as my topic, Bible and religion. Among other matters, I chided in a fairly gentle manner biblical scholars, especially students of the literatures of early Christianities, for resisting the social category religion in their work, and for markedly preferring the personal and experiential term faith. In so doing, I was mindful of the compound composition of my audience. And so I began by acknowledging the significant number of scholars then gathered in Boston, who held joint membership in the Society of Biblical Literature and the American Academy of Religion. I went on to recognize a smaller but no less significant segment of my audience by reminding those present that in the past decade, the North American Association for the Study of Religion, an organization that meets concurrently with the then SBLAAR, had devoted 4 full sessions at their annual meetings to theoretical questions in the study of religion raised by New Testament research. These sort of affinal relations, I suggested, constitute a massive syncretism, uncommon outside of North America, which holds out hope for the development of different practices and for experiments in reconceptualizations of both religious and biblical studies. Now, rehearsing these remarks before you 9 years later gives rise to no little sense of irony. A prophet I clearly am not. Since then, we have experienced our own version of the Millerite Great Disappointment. A rupture more recently eased, although surely not healed, by signs and portents of a new post-2011 dispensation. Indeed, had we met together with the AAR in Chicago this year, I would have begun this address not by referring to one of my own past appearances before this society, but rather to the 1936 publication in the Journal of Biblical Literature of a brief article, The Interpretation of Sacred Books, by the intellectual founder of the history of religions field at the University of Chicago, Joachim Vach. It is no doubt a reflection of our present time of troubles that I find it now necessary to state at the outset that nothing in that lecture, or this one for that matter, was or is intended to imply that the sorts of biblical scholarship represented by SBL was alien to the sorts of study of religion represented by the AAR. Taken together, the separate and shared scholarly interests of both associations reflect and inform elements of our normal science of religion. This is no new synergy. To pick out only one strand of a complex weave of intellectual academic histories. In pre-Ugarit days, Arabic was the chief cognate language to Biblical Hebrew, and therefore was a competence of many Old Testament scholars. Towering figures such as Wellhausen and Peterson used their skills in comparative Semitic philology to make important contributions to both biblical studies and to the study of Islam, thereby becoming immediately involved actively in the wider continental discussions and debates characteristic of that formative period of comparative religions as an academic field. By way of an aside, I would call attention as well to Peterson's remarkable 1914 comparisons of the Book of Mormon to the Quran, a project that remains the focus of a series of learned conferences sponsored by Brigham Young University. Other scholars, William Robertson Smith is perhaps the most familiar example, used the same philological learning to write classic theoretical works still influenced on contemporary students of religion. The question then of the recognition of biblical studies as both the past ancestor of and a present partner within religious studies is not an issue which has its primary locus in scholarly discourse, methodological disputation, or the history of scholarship. Rather, it has been, alas, to a considerable degree, an artifact of populist speech, generated by and reflected in linguistic ambiguities within common lexical usage in Anglo-American speech. Thus, Bible class, Bible reading, Bible study may signal either a private or ecclesiastical devotional practice or a public academic pursuit, more commonly the former. A Bible society is usually an organization for the printing and dissemination of Bibles as part of a missions program. Positive sectarian terms such as Bible Christian in the Wesleyan tradition join with pejorative vernacular ones such as biblically, biblicality, biblicism, biblicist, and biblist that signal an uncritical acceptance of biblical authority to continue the confusion. It's important here to recall that academic specialized usage is often designed to correct or replace such common lexical usages, nowhere more so than in the field of the study of religion, with its continuous revisionist efforts, ranging from the word religion itself to our central terms, such as myth and ritual. As I have come to know the practices of the SBL over the past 45 years I've been a member, for this society, biblical studies are not biblist studies. in striking contrast, for example, to the biblicism of the National Association of Biblical Instructors, the ancestor of the AAR, a fact which may provide a partial explanation for the AAR's recent suspicions. At the same time, I would insist with equal vigor that the phenomena such as devotional practices of Bible study have a proper place within histories of biblical interpretation, as well as within ethnographies of practices within Jewish and Christian religious communities, topics of appropriate study, surely, for both SBL and AAR. Now, this evening I'll take a different tack than 9 years ago, signaled modestly by the reversal of terms in my title. I want to focus on what might be termed matters of style, an apparent set of differences within our common enterprise that has led some students of religion to largely ignore biblical studies. I know for sure of no principled dissent from the proposition that biblical studies are religious studies by virtue of their subject matter. A focus on an authoritative collection of texts that elicit and determine both beliefs and actions that are properly characterized as religious, however that controverted term be understood. Both the study of religion and the study of religions, an enormous intramural battle, and the study of biblical literatures, taken as wholes, exhibit a similar fundamental ambivalence towards their subject matters, thoroughly typical of the human sciences in general. To employ a distinction first developed within the Freudian tradition, a tension between experience near and experience distant approaches and goals. Both academic endeavors profit from a perceived need for and a widespread appropriation of extraterritorial theories and methods from the wider human sciences. As complements to this latter process, there has been a reciprocal exchange of categories and at times of roles between religious and biblical studies. On occasion, I would observe, with insufficient reflection on the intellectual costs and implications of such transfers. As an example of the latter, the analogical use of the term Bible to denote scriptures, at times even sacred oral traditions of other religions, as in the often reprinted The Bible of the World or The World Bible, where that singular is even more inappropriate than when it is applied to this society's primary object of study. With more recognition of plurality, general introductions to the religions of the world are frequently taught to college students under titles such as Introduction to Sacred Texts or Scriptures, either by biblical or religious studies faculty, generating a growing number of textbooks and anthologies. In a parallel movement, biblical scholars have taken up structural categories initially formulated within generic studies of religion, such as sacred space or place, testing, applying, modifying, and thereby enriching them in relation to particular data. So, in service of this agendum, I propose this evening to first reinsert the Bible into the general history of the study of religion. Then I shall make a beginning at a redescription of biblical studies with the aim of reducing tensions as to style by emphasizing on our part in SBL that more attention needs to be paid to matters of comparison and to what Jonathan Boyarin usefully terms the ethnography of reading. This latter suggests that between the characteristic preoccupations of biblical scholars with an archaeology of origins and formations, and the already mentioned ethnography of contemporary usage of sacred texts in various religious contexts centered on the Bible, an endeavor, by the way, becoming prominent in religious and anthropological scholarship while still scanted in biblical studies, there lies a wide Middle Age expanse of applications, of traditions, in which the majority of students of religion comfortably dwell, and which forms the focus of much of their research and teaching. For many biblical scholars, perhaps due in part to the field's inheritance of early Reformation polemics, this middle range seems to remain a zone of discomfort, typically assigning its study to allied fields of institutional and intellectual history, church history, for example. For myself, one of the more exciting recent developments within the sacred space of our annual meetings has been the expansion of sessions that explore aspects of this middle range, bearing titles such as Rethinking the Concept and Categories of Bible, Then They Ruin It in Antiquity, History of Interpretation, along with particular foci, African, African-American, Asian, Asian-American, Latino, Latina, and Latin American hermeneutics, the Bible in Eastern and Oriental Orthodox traditions, as well as sessions on the use, influence, and impact of the Bible and the Bible and popular American culture. The implications of studying such middle range categories have been explored quite differently in our last two presidential addresses, and this area has been further strongly marked by the nomination of Vincent Wimbush as our next vice president. In one sense, I intend my remarks tonight to be a para-commentary on Robert Kraft's 2006 presidential address, especially the adverbs that dominate his subtitle, Beside, Before, and Beyond Biblical Studies. So allow me to begin the body of my address with a snapshot intended to record an originary moment in the modern enterprise of the study of religion. The German scholar Friedrich Max Müller, a resident of England for the bulk of his productive life, is one of the three figures often labeled with the Herodotean style epithet, father of the study of religion. Along with the Dutch scholar Cornelius P. Thiele, who in addition to biblical languages, read Akkadian, Egyptian, and Avestan, and would be my choice for the accolade if such a notion of paternity is even plausible. Muir's priority was acknowledged in 1887 by the third figure on whom the title is occasionally pressed, Pierre de Chantepie de la Saussaye. Muir himself persisted in naming as the first who ventured on a comparative study of the religions of the world the 16th century third Timurid Mughal emperor of northern India, Akbar, a figure best known to the English-speaking world through Tennyson's, in my judgment, lousy poem, Akbar's Dream. In the foreground of this evening's snapshot stands Muller's pioneering Introduction to the Science of Religion. Initially delivered as four lectures to a lay audience at the Royal Institution in February and March 1870, particularly his untitled second lecture of February 26. Consonant with his audience, Müller's addresses were first printed serially in the popular journal Fraser's Magazine for Town and Country, before being collected together with supplements and published in book form in 1873. Mueller's exceptional confidence in the enterprise of what he here terms the science of religion, his usual preferred term was comparative theology, more occasionally the comparative study of religions, grew out of the successes of comparative philology, the topic of his previous set of lectures to the Royal Institution on the science of language. Mueller's chief intellectual project was the transfer of the methods of the one field, comparative philology, into those of the other, the science of religion. Most especially, genealogical classification as the legitimation for comparison. Such genealogical comparisons, that is to say, homologies, were the foundation of the 19th century discernment of the Indo-European language family, and were widely considered through the middle 20th century to be a model of the scientific method. Beginning with Mueller's second lecture, and continuing for the remainder of that work, the comparative study of canonical scriptures is privileged as the first and foremost concern of the nascent science of religion. Mueller's initial strategic move is the introduction of a new taxon to the study of religion, a subset of the category book religions, which itself would appear to be an extension for comparative purposes of the Islamic category, people or peoples of the book. Mueller's coinage, religion of canonical books, is more limited and suffers in this book by Mueller's failure to provide a proper definition of canon. It may at first hearing seem unsurprising to you that a comparative philologist whose life's work was the production of the first critical edition of the Rig Veda, 1849 to 1874 in six fat volumes, an enterprise that transformed a previously oral text for the first time into a book, both in fact and theory, should focus on religion's linguistic artifacts, on written texts. What distinguishes his inquiries from those of his contemporaries and remains exemplary for our discussion is that for the purpose of disciplined comparative studies, he added the qualification that the sacred books must be collected into a sacred canon. In that imperial style of language we have learned over time to find exceedingly discomforting, Mueller distinguishes between, quote, the vulgar and nondescript crowd of bookless or illiterate religions and the aristocracy of real book religions, before exclaiming over his third category, how few are the religions which possess a sacred canon. Deploying the then commonplace linguistic dualism of Aryan, that is to say Indo-European, and Semitic, Mueller goes on to identify one ancestral canon for each religio-linguistic family, playing the same cognitive originary role as Proto-Indo-European and Proto-Semitic roots in comparative philological researches, with the advantage, he thought, that the respective canonical ancestral books, the Rig Veda and the Hebrew Bible, are extant entities, although surely not now in their initial forms, while the linguistic roots remain hypothetical, although no less significant scholarly reconstructions. In Mueller's genealogical classification within the Indo-European family, the Iranian Avesta stands as an independent member, the Buddhist Tipitaka as a dependent member, formed in reaction to and rejection of the older Indic religion. Within the Semitic family, the two additional members, the New Testament and the Quran, stand in dependent relations to the Hebrew Bible, analogous to that already described for the Buddhist. At a second level of comparison, the Buddhist Tipitaka and the New Testament are comparable in that both relatively rapidly transferred their respective religious traditions to another language family. The New Testament, while Semitic in origin, Hebrew Aramaic, became a document in Indo-European Greek. The Buddhist Tipitaka, while originally formulated in India, in Pali, flourished largely only when transferred and translated into a member of a third Asiatic linguistic family, to Chinese. Prompted by this latter, Mueller adds to his dual classification, Indo-European Semitic, a third independent Asiatic family, what we would now term the Sinitic branch of the Sino-Tibetan language family, which has two, for him, important book religions, each with a canonical collection serving as their sacred code. The nine Confucian classics, that is, the five classics plus the four books, and Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. Mueller concludes, with these eight religions, the library of the sacred canonical books of the whole human race is complete. Texts written in Sanskrit, Pali, and Avestan, in Hebrew, Greek, and Arabic, lastly, in Chinese. As these three families of Asiatic religions of canonical books correspond to the three major Asiatic language families, Mueller notes with no little satisfaction, quote, we really have clear evidence of three independent settlements of religion concomitantly with the three great settlements of language. And Mueller goes on to complicate usefully this discussion of original canonical settlements and secondary canons by introducing a tertiary level. Later texts, dependent on the primary canonical books, most often themselves subsequently treated as canonical. For example, the three other Vedas and the Brahmanas, the enormous expansion of the Mahayana Buddhist canon, noting especially its two Tibetan forms, the Khanjur and the Tenjur. In 1987, Karsten Kolpe published a paper on textual sacralization and the filiation of canons, which may be taken in part as a continuation and refinement of Mueller's taxonomic interests. Posing his questions in a quite different manner, Kolpe explored the formation of canons on the basis of an already existing paradigmatic text, and he focuses on two such filiations, one of whose archetype is the Hebrew Scriptures, the other the Buddhist Tipitaka. Note he thereby excludes Mueller's beloved and exemplary Rig Veda. In the first family, that of the Hebrew Scriptures, Kolpe lists the New Testament, Mishnah and its Talmuds, the Quran, and the Book of Mormon. In the second family, that of the Tipitaka, he lists the Mahayana Buddhist canon, the Jain canon, the Khanjur, the Tenjur, and the Tao Tsang. As an important complication, he proposes that the Sikh Adi Granth depends in varying degrees on both paradigms. I must say, a rather brilliant argument. As an aside, I would note that following Kolpe's lead, I taught for some years a year-long introductory course, Bibles in Western Civilizations, with one friendly amendment, consonant, I believe, with Kolpe's intent, reading and discussing as separate Bibles the Jewish Scriptures, Tanakh, and the Christian Old Testament, before going on to the New Testament, the Quran, and the Book of Mormon, adding other biblical texts from Joseph Smith's The Pearl of Great Price. Given Mueller's map of generative relationships and its modification by Culpa, as well as its taxonomic implications, the latter the subject of Mueller's third lecture, the comparison of book religions, Mueller argued, was methodologically grounded, inasmuch as it was based on the only scientific, I'm quoting, and truly genetic classification of religions, that which is the same as the classification of languages. Even if we set this last claim aside, and I would, a biblical scholar can and ought to make homological comparisons within one or the other of Mueller and Culpa's two families, as well as analogical comparisons between the families. For example, and I've alluded to it already, one of the striking differences between the Hebrew Scriptures' canonical family and the other family or families is the relative economy of the library of the former. One thinks by way of contrast of the Ming Taoist canon gathered with its 1607 supplement that contains 1,487 separate texts, or the already noted Chinese Mahayana Buddhist canon, 84,000 texts, and the distinctive Tibetan collections totaling together 4,681 titles. A scholar with an interest in comparison might well ask, what are the comparative advantages and disadvantages of size for interpretative endeavors? In ritual contexts, is there what old theology used to term a canon within the canon? What are the implications of a canon so large that it may not be readily possessed in its entirety? With respect to the latter question, a recent ethnographic report on Lao religious culture finds no reason to challenge a predecessor's 1917 notice that there was no extant complete edition of the Pali canonical texts in all of Laos. In undertaking either homological or analogical comparisons of canons, collaborative research will probably be required for reasons of linguistic competence and specialized knowledge. But the comparative enterprise itself may not and must not be avoided. The study of religion has been conceived from the outset as one that entails comparison. In Mueller's case, one that entails comparison of canons, and biblical scholars ought not to be allowed to avoid that requirement, even if their sense of professional prerequisites confines their comparisons to Mueller's and Culpe's first family. Mueller himself, quaintly, I think, calls attention as a sort of preparation for his gospel to the position, quote, which Christianity from the beginning took up with regard to Judaism, that serves as a first lesson in comparative theology, a sort of a primitive, savage attempt at science, along with the familiar contemporary practices of, quote, some of our most learned present-day divines in employing a limited comparison of Judaism and Christianity with the religions of Greece and Rome. In this account, academic irresponsibility would be a scholar's refusal of comparison, regardless of linguistic competence, in violation of Mueller's oft-cited dictum from the beginning of this set of lectures, he who knows one religion knows none. I should like neither Mueller, nor myself, nor the assembly of students of religion to be misunderstood at this point. What Mueller proposed and I affirm is not some division of labor between biblical scholars critically studying their chosen texts and making what Mueller termed limited comparisons to antecedent and environing traditions, and students of religion charged with undertaking more global inter-religious comparisons. For Mueller, the biblical scholar is a practitioner of what he termed the scholar of the science of religion to the degree that she sees her work as comparative, and I would argue the same. There is more. I've already had occasion to cite Mueller's remarks that with his enumeration of the sacred textual traditions of the 8 canonical book religions, quote, the library of the sacred books of the whole human race is complete, sort of a publisher's blurb. At a later point in the same lecture, he extends the collection's contents to include, quote, a library of the sacred books of the world together with their indispensable commentaries. These two mentions of library appear to forecast what will shortly become one of the major undertakings of Mueller's scholarly career, the proposal for and the editing of the 50-volume series of translations into English, The Sacred Books of the East, a collection that, to his intense and pained frustration, failed to include the Old or the New Testaments, due to the intense lobbying on behalf of Christian exceptionalism before the delegates of the university press at Oxford by one of the delegates, the Reverend E.B. Pusey, Regius Professor of Hebrew, Canon of Christ's Church, and one of the most influential High Church Anglican divines at the time. To Pusey's assertion of incomparability, Mueller answered with the creed of a student of comparative religion. Quote, these two, the most important sacred books of the East, could never have a better setting than in the frame formed by the other sacred books. In 1884, 5 years into the project of the sacred books of the East, Mueller reflected on the endeavor, offering along the way a part of what he had not provided in the science of religion, some indication of what constitutes a sacred book. He reports on what was clearly editorial committee discussions. It was suggested that those books only should be considered sacred which profess to be revealed or to be directly communicated by the deity to the great teachers of mankind. But it was soon found that very few, if any, of the books ever put forth such a claim. Such a claim was generally advanced and formulated by a later generation. So we agreed to treat as sacred books all those which had been formally recognized by religious communities as constituting the highest authority in matters of religion, and might therefore be appealed to for deciding any disputed points of faith, morality, or ceremony. Mueller here, please note, adopts a functional rather than a substantive definition. It is based on comparison and proposes an extrinsic rather than an intrinsic criterion for classification. It is the posterior usage of the book, not some anterior revelation, that marks it as sacred. This consequential shift raises the second issue with respect to style that we may draw from this foundational work in the history of the study of religion. If for Mueller, the biblical scholar is a practitioner of the science of religion to the degree that she sees her work as comparative, What Mueller proposes in his definition of sacred books, and I would affirm, is that the object of study in the case of sacred canonical books is not so much the text itself as it is its tradition, its trajectories, to use a term Friend Robinson made famous. For Mueller, you will recall, the data of a student of book religions includes not only the canonical texts and their secondary and tertiary formations, but also what he terms the indispensable commentary literature these have generated. The Nachleben, the afterlife of a canonical text, is as significant as the origins of the text. After all, the notion of the Bible itself is clearly a post-biblical phenomenon. The implications of such an extension for research and for teaching were raised with particular force, and I rarely cite him, by the late Canadian student of religion, Wilfred Cantwell Smith. A specialist on Islam and an influential theorist on questions as to the definition and study of religion. He was as well an informed scholar of what he terms characteristically with innumerable qualifications, Scripture. His last major work, What is Scripture? A Comparative Approach, 1993, is, as its subtitle indicates, a massive pioneering effort at comparison. And while I differ from many, many of his premises and conclusions, his book remains the best example I know that such a comparative enterprise is in fact possible. This evening, however, I want to direct your attention to an earlier and thankfully far shorter piece. Smith's 1971 publication in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, entitled The Study of Religion and the Study of the Bible. Smith begins by setting the educational context. The 1960s, emergence and flourishing of liberal arts departments of religion, the transition from the seminary to the liberal arts department as the locus of activity. To describe the consequences of such a shift, Smith employs, and I quote, the field as a Bible as an illustration. It's an example, it's not what the article in fact is driving at. Challenging, however, in so doing, both biblical studies and its educational practices. He critiques what he perceives to be, and I underline it's his perception, the antiquarianism of much biblical study, which focuses, he writes, on the prehistory and early history of components on the Bible, but rarely on its subsequent history. He imagines a course that would begin with some consideration of Scripture as a generic phenomenon, where the basic issue would be Scripture as a religious form, before turning to the bulk of the course, described in his oft-repeated phrase, the history of the Bible over the past 20 centuries. For Smith, the Bible is not best taught as a set of ancient documents or even as a formation of the early centuries, but through an exploration of trajectories through the full range of its history, to read it always in his terms, forwards as well as backwards. And he concludes his essay with a haunting question. Where could one find an individual with doctoral training equipping him in such a field? Now, if we accept Mueller's implicit and Smith's explicit agenda for the purposes of thought, for the study of biblical literature and comparable texts as an intrinsic part of the science of religion, we are called then not only to comparisons between canons, to comparative processes of canon formation and supplementation, but also to undertake comparative investigations of strategies for the interpretation of canonical collections, as well as comparative inquiries into their several ritual settings and employments. The latter are not appendices to the former. For as I argued in a 1979 comparative study of oral and written canons, the study, the distinctive characteristic of canon, in contradistinction to its generic partners, the list and the catalog, is that it is held to be complete, and that therefore a canon always requires an interpreter, a practitioner of what I there called exegetical ingenuity, to manipulate it in such a way that it covers novel situations without adding new matter to the canon. In recent years, spurred in part by new documentary recoveries, there have been increased interest in questions concerning the formation and limits and stability of the Jewish, Christian, Islamic, and Taoist canons, but rather little by way of a renewal of comparative efforts. It still remains the case that scholars concerned with one or the other of the two chief canonical families occasionally compare within their own lineage, but such discourse has rarely been extended to contemplate cross-lineage comparisons. A striking exception is found in the writings of the tragically short-lived scholar of Jain religious tradition, Kendall W. Bogert. He proposed a comparative classification of all known written canonical collections into two ideal, and I italicize that word, two ideal types, naming them with deliberate and almost clinical neutrality, Canon 1 and Canon 2 traditions, with the prime variable being the text's relationship, the means and mode by which the canon's authority is carried, what he terms its vector. Texts of the Canon 1 type are carried by some other form of religious activity, most frequently ritual. Texts of the Canon 2 variety are treated by their communities as self-authorizing. They are carried, he writes, by a vector of religious authority. As Folkert's dual classification was formulated in terms of ideal types, he observes that each form can and does appear within a single religious tradition, the two even existing simultaneously at times. An example would be his assertion that the Protestant Bible is a Canon 2 phenomenon, but through most of Christian religious history, and even still at present, the Bible usually functions as a Canon 1 text. This possibility of simultaneity, he cautions, forbids the presumption of a causal or developmental relation between Canon 1 and Canon 2. Johnny Court, a scholar of South Asian religions, has usefully restated the difference without resorting to the term vectoring, which hectors me. Canon 1, Court writes, changes with time and place. Authority flows from the accumulated tradition into the text. Canon 2 is more or less fixed and closed, and authority is conveyed via the text. Folkert drew his most detailed comparisons from the usages of the Jain and the Christian canons, attentive most particularly to providing ethnographic descriptions of the placement of the text within ritual space and the relations of various ritual specialists to the texts. For example, within Christian usage, among other elements, he distinguished between those Christian groups which employ the Bible in a strict lectionary fashion. That is to say, the canon is vectored by ritual and the liturgical year, as would be characteristic for Canon 1. And those Christian groups which use the Bible in a more random fashion, choosing texts for their relevance, a Canon 2 type practice. These observations parallel the sort of distinction elaborated by Miles Richardson and a 1993 work subtitled An Anthropologist's Account of Christian Performance in Spanish America and in the American South. Richardson compares the present-day ritual use of the Bible in two locales. I take it pre-Vatican, Spanish American, Catholic, and then North American Southern Baptist. He characterizes the Spanish American Catholic as sacramental with an emphasis on the visual, the Northern American Baptist less felicitously given other associations of the term as literal with an emphasis on the verbal. These two rubrics, whatever their adequacy, allow him to compare and contrast as paradigmatic examples. The Catholic hieratic display of the large, highly decorated gospel book to the congregation by the priest through an act of elevation, analogous to raising the Eucharistic elements. The priest is the sole lector of the text, the congregants by and large in the groups he studied lacking missals, thereby being wholly dependent upon the priest's reading and subsequent homily, received in silence except for responsorial formulae, with the Baptist preacher holding close to his body an open Bible, which does not differ in appearance from his congregants' copies, inviting the congregation to read along in your Bible with me, the text being woven into the preacher's performative speech with constant interjections from the congregation. Now, I've taken your time tonight with Volkert and Richardson, not merely for their comparative and ethnographic endeavors as a necessary feature of biblical scholarship as part of the study of religion, but also to note, and just note, a further issue that must be a part of any redescription of biblical studies, that alongside of a focus on ritual, on performance, equal to that given to myth, to sacred text, there be an equivalent concern for sacred texts as embodied material objects, commensurate with interests in those texts as documents of so-called faith and history. After all, canonization is as much, if not more, an affair of technology as theology. The perceived singularity of the Bible would have been impossible without the adoption of the codex form, the perceived uniformity of the Bible impossible without the invention of print. If the approaches I have emphasized this evening, the trajectories of traditions, comparisons, ethnographies, placed alongside of more familiar aspects of biblical studies, appear at all imperative to you as part of an enlarged redescription of biblical studies as religious studies, then Wilford Cantwell Smith's haunting question remains. Where would training in such endeavors lie? How would capacities in such approaches be evaluated as part of our professional competencies? I can think of no association that I would trust more as being able to address both the plausibility of such proposals as well as their implications for our field with respect to both scholarship and education than this society. Thank you.